Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Depot podcast. I'm Adna Chamjic and I'm your host for today. The podcast is an initiative of deindustrialization and the politics of our time, or Depot, a partnership of over 35 research centers, industrial museums, labor archives, trade unions, and other organizations across Italy, France, Germany, the UK, Canada, and the United States. It examines the political responses to deindustrialization as well as its historic roots and lived experiences. We can be found online at deindustrialization.org. This podcast is about covering the work of Depot and topics related to deindustrialization. We can be found on all major podcast services. In today's episode, we're going to have a chat with Leila Doni about her work on nuclear decommissioning. Leila is associate professor at the University of Exeter. She's a cultural geographer and social theorist. Welcome, Leila.
Hi.
Leila, your research has taken a fascinating trajectory from exploring the politics of affect, authority, and power in the late capitalist life to focusing on the aftermath of nuclear closures. I was wondering, how did your earlier work on affect and power influence your shift of focus to nuclear decommissioning? And if you could tell us more about the main questions you've been trying to answer through your research and how that drew you to examine nuclear closures and their impacts.
Okay, thank you. It's a bit of a story of coincidence, really, and being in the right place at the right time. So as you mentioned, my research has always explored that relationship between major economic change and experience about affect and embodiment and how change is felt at the body and community level. So the work that I have done historically has always paid attention to things like hopes and fears and attachments and alienations and how they are related to kind of broader processes of economic and social change. So one of the very clear empirical sites where we can look at that happening at a community level is often where a major economic change that affects a lot of people within that community has happened. So sites deindustrializing places has always been a central space of interest for me and my research. I was about to begin a project in deindustrializing South Wales in the valley, in the valleys, and I was thinking about some of these ideas through and how they are kind of felt and experienced in deindustrializing places. And just at that time, I met up with a couple of friends of mine, Laurie Griffiths and Jonty Takon, who are photographers, and they mentioned that they were going to Lithuania, to this town called Visaginas, which was the site of a decommissioning nuclear plant. And the story they told about the place was so fascinating and interesting to me, and so apposite to the kinds of ideas that I'd been exploring more conceptually and in my library research, that I said, please, can I come along? Can I join you? And you know, we'll hang out in Lithuania. So I came along and found this extraordinary place, and this place that did indeed make me think very, very differently about these questions about loss and memory and nostalgia and industrial decline, and proved to be a site that we went back to again and again and again over the next 8 years, 9 years now. So it's a kind of coincidental story, but the site came out of a very, very clear kind of line of trajectory into thinking about what empirical spaces help one to think through some of these ideas around how communities experience change.
Thank you, Leila. And so I was wondering, so you ended up in Visaginas, which is a former Soviet atomic grad in Lithuania, where you conducted this field work, and you also published an article about that called Decommissioning Places, Ruins, Endurance, and Care at the End of the First Nuclear Age. Could you dig deeper into that experience of Visaginas? And in your article, you challenge this modernist narrative of progress, decline, and renation. So could you tell us something more about how these communities continue to inhabit and care for these spaces, and how do you challenge these narratives of decline?
So I think the idea for this article came really directly from reflecting on the way in which we as researchers and photographers engaged with the field. So initially, we were expecting to see a place of decline, a place of decay, and a place of a vacancy. And I think there was a sense to which we kind of wanted to see that, and we were interested in that sad story of loss. But when we got to Visaginas and on our subsequent visits, that story just didn't fit. That didn't fit what we were seeing. That didn't fit the way in which the people that we spoke to understood their relationship to the community. And for sure, there's this very strong attachment to the past and a very strong attachment to the legacy that the quite specific history of this town brings people. But what we were more interested in was the way in which people were living on, the way in which people maintained their relationship to the place in different ways, because that anchoring institution of the nuclear plant doesn't have the same hold that it once did. And the political structures and the economic structures that supported the town have changed. But nevertheless, this wasn't a place that was mired in the past. This wasn't a place that felt terribly sad. This was a place full of people, and is a place full of people who are actively choosing to remain, who are making different kind of lives with the resources that remain there from the town's history. So because we were forced to challenge our preconceptions about the place, which of course research should do, that really helped us to think about how care and endurance might be more useful words to describe places that have undergone those kind of changes. So the focus of the paper then was definitely, you know, much more about how we can visually challenge those dominant tropes of ruination, and also how we can challenge it through our social science work and refuse to buy into easy narratives of decline.
What I found really fascinating about the paper was the use of pictures, and you were saying that you were collaborating with the photographers, and I was wondering how the use of pictures helped you also tell this story of life in the aftermath of ruination. Do you think the visual part has a crucial role in telling that story, or it could have been done but differently without the visual support?
I think what's been really interesting about this project is that it's always been such a close collaboration. So Laurie and Jonty, the two photographers, and I worked closely together the whole time. I was with them when they were shooting. We had conversations before leaving, driving around. They accompanied me with interviews. So we were really getting a flavour of how each other work. And of course, the way in which we think and interact with the world is differently because of our different skills. Throughout, a kind of mutual enriching of the work that we were doing. For me, you know, as a social scientist, I look at people all the time. I think about people, and I use words and language, and that's my medium. So working with people whose primary medium is visual made me look more closely at my surroundings, made me think about the physical environment of the space a lot more, and in turn, the way I could bring political and economic context to some of the things that we were seeing, and my, you know, background in social science analysis that helped me explain phenomenon to Laurie and Jonty, meant that I think we all gained so much from that collaboration. I think it's lovely to have beautiful images as well, but they do more than just illustrate the writing that I've done. They're very much part of the story that we're telling. I see our role primarily as storytellers, and what we've tried to do throughout is maintain a real fidelity to our participants and to the people that we met, and try and really kind of communicate their experience through the different media. And I'm not sure that my words alone would be enough to do that.
You've also written about resistance through everyday practices. And could you elaborate more on how such resistance is manifested in the daily life, like in Visaginas, for example, in Lithuania? And could you tell us maybe some more examples of this kind of resistance? And do you think that this resistance is constructed through and thanks also to these effective bonds that were created between the people and the infrastructure that was constructed there? So is it the basis, like, for resistance, for civic participation, public life, and endurance in the aftermath of the closure?
I'm not sure that what we were seeing was necessarily resistance. I think I've used terms like endurance and living on to describe staying somewhere, wanting, making an active decision to remain somewhere after perhaps you're seen as surplus to requirements or unnecessary. So I suppose in a way that is a form of resistance. That's a form of refusing, perhaps more than resistance, refusing to just do the right thing and go somewhere else. So I think endurance becomes a term. And the anthropologist Felix Ringel discusses this too. Which is about making a claim on your right to remain somewhere and making that happen, making that possible. So what we see in somewhere like Visaginas is that there are certain resources that are available, and perhaps that's due to its history. Those kind of resources include very cheap accommodation, beautiful surroundings, a very close and active community, meaning that it's people's need for interaction and leisure and recreation are very comfortably fulfilled, and creativity. So I think rather than resistance, I would kind of say this is about a refusal to go elsewhere, a commitment to remaining, and a way of actively using the resources that are there to try and live a different kind of life that works for the people that want to stay.
Maybe you could tell us something more about the people that you interviewed and that you work with. Were they former workers or just community members? So, yeah, what kind of people were you interacting with? Is it people who decided to stay? Did they have the opportunity to leave and they actively decided to stay there? And what motivated them to stay there?
So we tried to speak to people from lots of different generations. The oldest person we spoke to was in her 80s, and she was actually one of the original pyrators of the power plant. We spent a lot of time speaking with the children of those early settlers and people who built the town and the plant in the 1970s and 80s, because they are the generation really that has seen the greatest change and have committed to staying in Visaginas. So we spoke to a lot of former workers, and many of them being a bit older are living quite happy retirements and they're able to stay because of their pensions and redundancy pays. We also spoke to many present workers at the power plant because, of course, the decommissioning process goes on and on. It's a very long, slow, drawn-out process. And because of the nature of working with nuclear, you know, things have to be very carefully monitored. It's not just a matter of taking a wrecking ball to a site. So it's still a big employer. So we spoke to many people who are currently working there as well. And then we spoke to a much younger generation of younger people who have often left and come back. So worked abroad for a few years and then decided to come back to Visaginas to raise a family because they feel like it's such a strong, good environment to raise children in, or people that appreciate the peace and quiet there because it is a very calm place to live. And teenagers who, you know, are finding things to do in a small town and asking them about what they're thinking about doing next, whether they will go away, whether they come back, what's their relationship to the place. So across the generations, we see a continued shared sense of attachment to the town, very, very strong attachment, and also a sense that perhaps the reason why people haven't left, even though it might be economically beneficial for them to do so, is that they feel that it's very unique, that this history that they share, these cultures of science and technology, which were very, very strong in the town and continue to be so, the fact that they are Russian-speaking in Lithuania, which does position them in a difficult place. You know, they are treated with hostility in other parts of Lithuania. So the town provides this safety, this place of safety for them, this home which they feel very, very attached to and keep returning to again and again.
Can we say that there is a sort of resistance to change and like a will to preserve a sort of status quo that they acquired through working in that industry? Because we know I work on nuclear energy history in Italy, and people who were working in the nuclear industry at nuclear power plants really had a high status, economic status in the society. So would you say that there is a sort of resistance to change and maybe to different kinds of future that are connected also to this idea of a lost future that they could have but that never materialized, or that the closure suddenly stopped from materializing and the people are kind of having difficulty in imagining different ways of life without the nuclear power plant?
I think it's hard to say whether people have difficulty imagining different ways of life. I mean, certainly many people have gone to work elsewhere. I'm not sure to say that there's a lack of imagination would be entirely fair. I think what's happening is an active choice to be somewhere that feels like home. So whether that's resistance, which is, you know, a point we've come back to, is a tricky one because it's also about belonging and attachment and refusing to leave. I mean, there's no overt pressure to leave, but nevertheless, there's economic pressure to leave. A lot of people deal with this by working away for periods of time and then returning. So that's something that we see a lot of. In terms of wanting to remain in the past or not wanting things to change, it's been a long time since it was announced that the Ignalina plant, which is the nuclear plant attached to the town, was to close and that the reactors were to be shut down. It's been 20 years now. So I think that resistance to change has well and truly vanished. It's an interesting time, really, because the moment of shock, the moment of having to really radically reassess one's life and to think about those lost futures is firmly in the past. So it's a time more of acceptance. You know, this is what it is. And we're choosing to make it into something which is the best it can be.
I find this also really fascinating because, as you were saying, we usually approach the industrialized spaces as ruined spaces, as spaces where people are willing, spaces that people are willing to abandon or to that are willing to go away from. But you are telling us a story in which actually there is a sort of, I don't know if we could call it transition or transformation, maybe also sort of transformation of labor within the nuclear power plant, from operating the nuclear power plant to decommissioning it, right? And it seems to me that there has been a sort of, as you said it, as you mentioned, adaptation and will to by the people who are there to transform and to adapt to these new conditions, and which is something I think is really challenges these perspectives that we usually have about these places. Would you agree with that? Like with this form of adaptation, do you see any sort of frustration in the new job that the people are doing? For instance, on nuclear decommissioning, they are sort of decommissioning something that they worked on actively, that maybe they also contributed to build, or that their fathers or grandfathers contributed to build, and now they are working to destroy this. So how does this impact emotionally the people there?
I think it impacts people significantly. As you pointed out, Adna, this town, the nuclear plant, didn't exist. It was empty marshland for most of the 20th century, and then it was decided that this would be the site to build this major Central European power plant by the USSR. And people were decamped there. There was nothing there. They were living in tents and building this place from scratch. So there was this kind of pioneer mentality and very, very collective people. For many years, were sharing apartments with multiple families as they built more of the town. And it is these people and their children and their grandchildren who are still there. So to take something away which you can lay such a claim on is a real, really, really hard thing to do. You know that your grandparents, your parents were there. They were living there. They were, you could point to a building that they were involved in construction. That ongoing history of labour in nuclear power, which is of course so specialist and quite unusual. For all of these reasons, it's a huge emotional burden, and it's a huge sense of loss. But I think, and I don't think this is unique to this place, because certainly we see similar examples of this in, for example, former coal communities and former steel communities, is that there is a resilience in the kinds of community formations that are associated with these kind of industries. and with big employers. And there are sets of social institutions that emerge through those forms of big industry, which can support people and which can help people manage change. And it's those community ties that often get people through those changes, and also are really central to their decisions to remain, even when places feel like they are in decline.
I was also wondering, like, if these bonds that people have with this infrastructure, which is a nuclear infrastructure, you were talking about coal and other types of industries, and I was wondering what is so specific with the... Is there anything that is more specific to the nuclear industry? Is there a source of risk perception or a narration of risk that is that feels different? And so is there any additional difficulty in speaking about these everyday lives at nuclear sites, which is an industry that is always perceived as so exceptional and so risky and so difficult to understand and so detached from everyday life, right?
I think one of the central ways in which nuclear decommissioning gets set apart from other stories of deindustrialization is that the figure of the nuclear worker doesn't have the same cachet as the steel worker or the coal miner. You know, there are very specific articulations of masculinity in those roles, of heroic masculinity, which are narratives around kind of leftist fantasies of solidarity and loss. And they're really strong, powerful narratives and images. The nuclear worker doesn't really have access to that. They're not seen as heroic. The kinds of cultural imaginaries around nuclear labour just it isn't as romantic. So I think that is one of the reasons why the nuclear power worker gets set apart from maybe other kinds of deindustrialization. And this is, you know, this is a problem for a town which is built around nuclear power, is that, you know, from it is always seen as so closed and so secret that people who work there are treated with suspicion, or also people are treated with ridicule. So many of the people that we interviewed expressed a feeling of shame about where they were from, mentioned that if they were in Vilnius or if they were in another place, they might not mention where they were from because they knew that people would see it as a kind of joke or see it very negatively or think that they might be in some way contaminated. You know, these are the kinds of popular fears that people hold around the nuclear industry. So there isn't a sense of great pride in coming from a nuclear community as there might be coming from, for example, a former mining town. So I think that's one of the central ways in which people's experiences can be different. There isn't the same level of public sympathy. Another way is less risk than the security cultures that surround nuclear. The tightness of security, the sense of secrecy that surrounds a lot of the work that's being done, all of this leads to quite closed cultures. So I think this marks it out as well. In a way, the risk aspect of the job on a day-to-day basis actually leads to a short day, a very calm day, because you have to go through so many processes in order to get to your workplace. Everything moves very slowly. It's not particularly a high stress environment most of the time because of the management of risk, because of the safety measures that people who work in the nuclear plant have to undergo. So in terms of risk, I think that's how risk gets articulated in people's everyday lives more than anything else. It doesn't feel like a high stress thing. It feels more like a series of habits and processes that one has to go through, which, you know, are probably quite boring.
Yes, and that probably they developed such a safety culture, such a strong safety culture that enabled them to tackle risk or to go through risk situations, and probably also perceive them in a different way. And so just this is out of curiosity. Have you seen, has it emerged that any of those workers collectively organized for any issues related to their work? Has this emerged in your conversations, or there haven't been experiences, such experiences at the workplace? Were there any trade unions at the nuclear power plant, or it wasn't really common there?
Yeah, this wasn't something that we spoke about much, actually, but there is a union. I don't know that much about it. I don't know if there are different unions for different parts, different types of workers, but I know that organised labour was, you know, very important and seemingly quite lacking in hostility way in which business took place within the decommissioning plant. But it wasn't something we were particularly asking questions about.
And also, what about when the plant closed? So the plant was also one of the major producers of energy, I imagine, there, of electricity there. So what happens? Are there any new industries that were developed around, or is there any transformation in that regard? Where does the electricity come from now, if you know that?
Why the closure was such a shock was partly due to the fact that there was no real alternative economic plan for the area at all. For a place that contained so much expertise, so much knowledge, it's quite extraordinary, really, that there wasn't any sense of how that could be used elsewhere, apart from through the decommissioning process. So the decision to close the plant wasn't part of a broader energy transition process. It was very much, we need to close this plant because Lithuania needs accession to the European Union, and this is a condition of that accession. Since then, a couple of small industries have opened up. There's a furniture factory, there's a medical supplies factory, but not providing that much employment, and certainly not providing employment at the pay and perks level that the nuclear plant did. So that's, you know, that hasn't replaced what the nuclear industry was providing. Decommissioning, more than anything else, replaces that because that comes with the nuclear pay supplement in the same way. Another big, big blow to the people who lived in Visaginas when the reactors shut down was, of course, the lack of access to free energy, because that was very much part of the package, part of the deal. And interviewees talked to me about the moment when the reactor closed and they were reconnected to the main grid, which is what happened, and how everybody's lights dimmed. So there was just this small moment at midnight, I think it was over the new year, when the lights just dimmed slightly and they knew that they were no longer getting their power from the grid. What that means now is that people's heating costs are very high, because the heating systems were developed at a time when the idea was that there would be this limitless energy coming from the nuclear plant. The hot water gets piped in from the cooling processes and heats all of the flats in the town. Now that has to now be powered by gas. So there are, these are the kind of everyday domestic articulations of this change that we've seen, and that's a big problem because it is expensive. Energy is expensive. In the winter, Lithuania gets very, very cold, and people's apartments need to be heated. So there are practical implications of these things too.
And what is the relationship to the government, to the different levels of government there in Lithuania, now that with this decision to close the power plants for the EU accession process? So is there any kind of frustration connected to these political decisions, and how do people see this, and what kind of relationship do they have to the general government, to the general politics, policy levels?
So this is a really tricky question, and I'm not sure I can answer it fully. The difficulty has always been that the community in Visaginas is a Russian-speaking community, and are perceived very much as non-Lithuanians, as settlers from the Soviet times. So they represent a troubled history. That makes itself known and felt in national and local policy. The lack of language acquisition, the lack of people that were competent in Lithuanian language, has meant that people can't necessarily get jobs outside of the town, which is a bit of a Russian-speaking enclave. You know, Russian is a lingua franca, less than it used to be, but nevertheless still widely spoken. This is changing slowly. Schools are teaching in Lithuanian more. But these are big cultural barriers to integration. And they're also major reasons why the community hasn't perhaps been resourced historically as well as it could have been in terms of economic regeneration. So there's a fraught relationship with local and national government, and the current situation in Russia is not helping this in any way. So it's touchy and difficult ground. And I think, you know, in these kind of conditions, there is an element of retreat that happens where people stop going further out into the world and retreat among the people who they know, which we're seeing globally at the moment as well, and it's certainly felt there.
And what about the perspectives for the closure? When is the decommissioning process expected to end, and then if there are any plans for the aftermath of decommissioning, which is probably going to be the real closure?
I think it's around 25 years. These horizons endlessly recede, so it changes all the time. There will be a repository built there, a geological repository. There's already an above ground repository. The vision is the vision of a green meadow to restore the site to nature. It will be interesting whether that happens and how that happens. It's a slow process, and there are very, very tricky aspects of full decommissioning which haven't yet been worked out. No one really knows how to remove the core of a graphite moderated reactor. As the years go by, as years of radiation exposure have an effect on the graphite, they make it incredibly brittle, incredibly crumbly. It's really, really hard to move that stuff. We don't have the robotics technology to get that done as yet. We're not sure how to do it. And this is a problem which people are trying to solve all the time, but we're not quite there yet. So there's a lot of unknowns really with nuclear decommissioning. And of course, one of the major issues being, where does the processed waste go? The storage problem is quite central to this. There's a sense to which one might want to just wait a bit longer, because storage problems will be solved, because technology will be there, and then we can get on with it. There are also reasons why one might want to just leave a site as is for quite a long time and then deal with it later because of the half-lives of particular radionuclides. So it's a bit of a kind of, it's just a long and ongoing process, and there isn't really an end game that we can see at the moment. There are, of course, the plans for decommissioning that would have been designed at the time, but these change all the time because of the development of new technologies.
So we are going towards the end of our conversation, I think. After publishing your article in 2019 on decommissioning places, the one we were talking about, you also returned to Visaginas to work on a new project, and you made a film. You contributed to the making of a film titled Decommissioning a Dream, directed by the same photographers that you collaborated with in the past. So what made you go back there, and are you still planning to go on working on that town, or have you been working on some other places, the industrialized places, wondering about working on some other places in the future?
Yeah, we felt that the project wasn't yet complete, I think. So the first set of visits to Lithuania led to photographic exhibitions in London and Vilnius, and also a few publications. But we wanted to produce something more that was more a kind of storytelling and that would reach a wider audience. So last year, we made the decision to go back and develop the work that we had done into a short film, Decommissioning a Dream. Having spent so long in the place and having thought about it so much, it wasn't a hard film to make. We talked a lot about the story, and we talked about a lot about our desire to tell the story of these people and to not inflect it with any kind of commentary or narrative or kind of political slant. It doesn't have any of the cynicism, I think, that we sometimes see in contemporary academia. It's very much a film about people telling their story. We called it Decommissioning a Dream because we really wanted to highlight the idea of the good life, the idea of the Soviet nuclear dream, which was absolutely central to the making of that place and central to the buy-in that people had for the place and for their attachment to the place, and to really highlight what it means to people to take apart that dream and take apart those lost futures. So the film was definitely about taking a part of the story that we'd thought about through the photographic work and through the academic work and just telling it as it is and bring it to a different group of people.
So you mentioned contemporary academia, and looking forward, how do you see the future of post-industrial communities in academic discourses? And do you think this research on deindustrialized places can also shape new political or social strategies for these regions, maybe for the re-evaluation of these industrial landscapes?
I would very much like there to be, and it would be something that I'm really interested in working on in the future. I presented some work on this in a conference earlier this year, and someone in, I think it was the chair, said to me, "We need forgotten places, we need lost places." And I think what's very interesting about the potential of deindustrialized places, and we see this globally, is that they can act as kind of experimental spaces. Often land and property is cheap. Often nobody's really interested in claiming them. And so they do provide opportunities for people who want to think differently or live differently to try stuff out. And that's true in places of rural vacation as well. So a deindustrialization of the countryside, just as it's true of urban spaces. So I suppose my hope is that some of the experiments, the social experiments, the economic experiments that we can see in places that have traditionally been understood as places of decline could be encouraged, celebrated, used to rethink ideas around urban planning or around economic development, and the kind of values and priorities that people hold on to in these places, the strong sense of community cohesion, a DIY attitude, a commitment to remaining. I think there's a hope that these metrics, these values can be recognized by policymakers too.
Are there any future plans that you would like to share with us or future projects that you're working on currently?
So the next stage in this project is to continue the storytelling theme and to create a book version of the story. So again, that's in collaboration with Laurie and Jonty, and we'll be combining storytelling with photographs and with some archive material as well to once again tell the story of this place in a quite different way. The focus will definitely be much more about temporality, which is been hiding throughout the project, but will be given much more of a foregrounding in this next stage. So that's the process. And then Laurie and Jonty and I will be developing the next phase of this project, which will be finding a different space to think about the idea of the afterwards or the aftermath, a space that remains and exploring the communities there, but that we're going to give ourselves time to think about where to go next.
Leila, thank you very much for your encouraging words and words of hope. And I really wish you the best for this project. And thank you very much for participating in our podcast to discuss your really fascinating work on nuclear closures, which has been really inspiring for me. As we wrap up, I should also mention that Depot is hosting its annual conference in Paris this June from the 19th to the 21st of June to further discuss the industrialization across the world. Thank you, Leila.
Thank you, Adna. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to talk about the work.
Again, this podcast is an initiative of Depot Network and can be found on all major podcast services. Our website is deindustrialization.org, which is full of information about the project, and you can go sign up for a monthly email newsletter. Thank you again for listening to this episode, and we'll be back again soon. Goodbye.